on Ways and Means for February 23rd, 2005. I will also simultaneously open up the public hearing on SB 5522, the Oregon Health Science University. We have a lot of people here to testify this morning. If the committee assistant could note that any member that is not here is excused, I anticipate they will all ultimately be here. Mr. Bender has been very gracious to us this morning. He is sitting in the far right corner over there. It's kind of fitting having OHSU here because the status of some of my Senate members and House members and now staff. Mr. Bender is sitting back there because he has laryngitis and he does not want to actually potentially infect any of the committee members. But he is available should we have a question. He will respond very, how would I say it, very quietly, but he will respond to the question. We will start off the presentation today. This is the bill, of course, on the Oregon Health Sciences University. We have 2 days to get through this, and we have a lot of people to testify. So we're going to have to stay pretty much on schedule. The first person to testify is going to be Keith Thompson, the chair of the OHSU board. Mr. Thompson. And for the sake of the record, I think somebody could nod their head. Maybe miss. What we have before us are replacement pages for the book that we have.
And I'll walk you through that.
And if others could identify themselves for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today and tomorrow. For the record, my name is Keith Thompson, and I'm pleased to serve as the chairman of the Board of Directors of Oregon Health and Sciences University. Before I talk about OHSU, I think it's worth pointing out that I'm a relative newcomer to OHSU and the academic health centers. I joined Intel Corporation in 1969 when there were 90 employees, and then I spent the next 30 years in the most exciting growth of a Fortune 100 corporation. I was responsible for the site selection and construction of the first Intel site in Oregon in 1974. In 1979, I moved a business organization and my family to Oregon in what was to be a 2-year assignment. I subsequently decided to stay here and participated in the Oregon expansion to what is now Intel's largest and most comprehensive site worldwide. So I've spent most of my life as a businessman with a high-tech engineering background. Other than being the occasional patient, I knew little about healthcare or healthcare education. But I became involved with OHSU through my service on the Oregon Graduate Institute Board. As part of the OGI-OHSU merger in 2001, the governor appointed me to the OHSU board. Beginning last year, at the suggestion of Governor Kulongowski, I was elected by the board to serve in the role of chairman. As a businessman and a board member, I have been exposed to the people and involved in the daily workings of OHSU, and I have been very impressed with the economic impact and the return on investment, or ROI, that OHSU provides to the state of Oregon. What's more, I have learned a lot and really been impressed with what I'd like to call the human ROI that OHSU provides to the citizens of Oregon. Let me focus on the business aspects first. Since 1995, when OHSU became a public corporation, we were tasked to operate more like a business. On behalf of the Board of Directors, I can tell you that we take that charge very seriously and are constantly mindful of our public mission. The track record of business performance at OHSU since 1995 has been exemplary. OHSU has nearly doubled employment to over 11,500 workers. The annual operating budget has also doubled to over $1.2 billion. OHSU is Portland's largest employer and among one of the largest businesses in the state. Between direct and indirect jobs, OHSU generates about 42,000 jobs in communities throughout Oregon and about $2.7 billion in annual regional economic activity. Research awards at OHSU has nearly quadrupled in the last decade, with over 1,300 individual awards worth $260 million in 2004. 95% of those dollars are from out-of-state funds. In fiscal year 2004, the amount of out-of-state dollars topped $247 million. $222 million were awarded through merit-based, peer-reviewed grant processes at federal agencies such as the National Institute of Health and the National Sciences Foundation, all very competitive processes. Each new research grant awarded at OHSU is the equivalent of bringing a new small business that generates jobs, salaries, and revenue to Oregon. In addition, technology transfers from OHSU Discoveries have founded 16 spin-off companies in the last 3 years alone, most of which elected to form and stay in Oregon. I believe those numbers and performance demonstrate the economic impact and return on investment that OHSU provides to the state. OHSU earns $27 in grants, gifts, contracts, and service funds for every dollar the state invests in OHSU. That is an important metric and one worth repeating. A 27 times payback for an investment is one anyone would like to make and compares well to the other economic impact studies that are out there from respected economic engines like Nike and Intel in our state. On top of all that, OHSU also returns nearly $37 million back to the state each year through employee income taxes and other payroll taxes. But financials are not the only way to measure OHSU's impact on the state. Another is the human return on investment. OHSU is a vital provider of critical social services with unique statewide education and health care programs and extensive outreach to low-income and special needs patients. That's the public part of our mission. OHSU schools educate the next generation of healthcare providers, scientists, and engineers in a wide array of fields. In 2004, we taught nearly 2,600 students, over 1,000 interns, residents, postdoctoral fellows, and clinical trainees, and approximately 18,000 continuing education participants. Many of these programs, such as primary care in the School of Medicine, graduate programs in the School of Nursing, and biomedical engineering in the School of Science and Engineering, are all unique in Oregon, and as you will hear later, highly respected nationally. As Oregon's only health and research university, OHSU's high-quality patient care incorporates the latest research technology and innovation, providing Oregonians with a level of treatment unmatched elsewhere in the state. OHSU is known for taking the latest knowledge from the laboratory to the patient bedside. OHSU is also known historically for shouldering a significantly disproportionate share of indigent care. OHSU provides nearly twice the state average of care to the poor compared to other regional health care providers. Now, that's an admirable record, but I have to ask if it's appropriate in these tight fiscal times for one institution to carry so much of the burden when it could be shared amongst other providers. Speaking for the board of directors, we believe the state should help us look at ways to spread the responsibility more equitably. The statewide reach of OHSU community service programs is nothing less than astounding. OHSU has more than 200 organized community outreach programs. Our employees volunteer more than 25,000 hours per year, touching the lives of more than 250,000 people annually. These services reach across the 96,000 square miles of Oregon and beyond. In sum, OHSU provides community service programs worth more than $150 million annually. Now, that's a fairly brief overview of what is a very complex institution. No matter how you look at it, whether in terms of economic activity or social good, OHSU provides a tremendous return to the state. I know of no other institution in Oregon that provides a better economic ROI in terms of jobs created, resources brought into the state, and overall economic activity generated. I'm equally confident that no institution in Oregon provides a better human ROI in terms of people served, communities reached, and lives touched. Now, Dr. Peter Kohler, our president, will give you some more details as well as outline how we have scheduled the testimony for today and tomorrow to brief you on the various pieces of OHSU. I appreciate your time and attention. Pete?
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. For the record, my name is Peter Kohler, President of Oregon Health and Science University, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for hearing us out today. As Keith said, I'm going to take a few minutes to provide a brief overview of our agenda for today and tomorrow and to introduce some of the speakers who represent OHSU. I think these are shown on the slides. Today, we will focus our presentation on education as well as outreach and rural health. You will hear from Dr. Leslie Halleck, our provost, who is sitting at the table with us here, Dr. Kate Potempa, who is dean of our School of Nursing, and Karen Whitaker, who is vice provost and director of rural health. Tomorrow, Dr. Halleck will return to discuss healthcare delivery with testimony by Brian Rogers, who's here in the audience, the director of our CDRC. I will discuss research tomorrow and the Oregon opportunity before Dr. Halleck returns to discuss budget impacts. And Chair Thompson will return to close the session, summing up OHSU, its people and programs, its achievements and challenges from the perspective of our Board of Directors. Now, before I hand this over to Dr. Halleck, let me provide the members of the subcommittee with a brief view of OHSU as an institution. You can see there the institutional profile, which I will begin with. We became a public corporation in 1995, and I think that since that time and before, we have had a great deal of success, both in terms of economic and human terms. The Senate Bill number 2 in 1995 created the public corporation. The statute provided for a streamlined governance structure that allowed for efficient and timely program and business decisions, which was very critical to us in the wake of Measure 5, and a public mission in partnership with the state to provide the educational programs and community health care services that were needed. So we think the state deserves a great deal of credit for this transformation from a state agency to a public corporation in 1995. This does provide for a partnership with the state. We gained responsibility for succeeding in a highly competitive market, but we retained the core mission of OHSU, teaching, research, patient care, and community outreach. You've heard the slogan, where healing, teaching, and discovery come together. I think that describes OHSU very well. We were asked to operate more like a business, but retaining the core missions. The next slide shows you a look at our overall budget. As a result of the public corporation, we were able to invest in our patient care facilities, which were badly in need of investment at that time. Deferred maintenance at the time we became a public corporation was in aggregate well over $400 million. We were able to bring our communities up to community standards, our facilities up to community standards. And today we are acknowledged as the top-rated hospital in terms of consumer surveys provided by outside sources. You can also see how we've changed in that patient care in the red is by far and away the largest component of our budget. Second is gift grants and contracts. That reflects the success of our research programs. The other parts of our support, including the state appropriation, are very important to what we do, but you can see that they're a far smaller part of our support level than they were, for example, when I was recruited in 1988, and they represented 27% of our support level. The next slide shows a picture of our total revenue. You can see there in the middle of that slide the point at which we became a public corporation in 1995. And since that time, as you can see, our research is up dramatically, really a reflection of strategic investments in research and clinical care. The clinical investments were facilitated by the public corporation transformation, and we were able, for example, to invest in resources, which in fact can bring back to the state the increase in revenue, both from research grants and from the clinical programs. This next slide, I think, bears a little bit of a scrutiny, because I think it's really important to get a sense of our history going down on the left there, beginning in 1975, when we had an operating budget of $80 million to the present time when it's about $1.2 billion. You can also see in the orange column the percent state support, which is a decrease in terms of percent, actually also in terms of absolute dollars. The grant awards is part of our, we think, success story. This has increased to an award level last year of $260 million, most of which comes from the National Institutes of Health. Chair Thompson described our growth in terms of numbers of employees, and the number of students has also increased, reflecting in part our merger with OGI. So we are much larger than we were, certainly in 75, but also in 95. Our budget has increased, and I think this has all reflected a benefit to the state. One of the things that I think we don't adequately describe is how have we done this? How have we grown our programs in the face of diminished support from the state? What is the trick here that has allowed us to do this? And I think that it goes back to why is the state support that we receive so important. It generally supports our educational mission. That's where it goes. Provost Halleck will show you more slides to this later on today. But we are able to take that state support, reduce the amount of money we give per faculty member to reflect as well as we can adjust it the amount of time they spend on education, and then basically ask them to bring in the rest of their support. If they're researchers, we ask them to bring in grant support. If they're clinicians, we ask them to bring in clinical support to then give them their composite total salary. Now, this has worked relatively well up to the present time, but there is a point at which we give them so little, it makes it easier for them to move. The people that we have on our faculty are in great demand. They are people who generate huge amounts of NIH support. They're being recruited all the time. At the same time we're recruiting, people are recruiting our faculty members, particularly those who are the most successful. The same thing is true for our clinicians, those who do particularly well, those who help us carry the indigent care that we provide, are also very good targets for recruitment by not only our local institutions but nationally. And a lot of our competition, frankly, is at the national level. So I think that what we have done is leverage. We've used that term leverage, and what that means to me is reducing the amount of support per faculty member to that which reflects education and asking these individuals to bring in the rest of their support. They have responded to that. But there is a bit of a morale issue as we contend with increasing cuts to our base budget. So let me close then with a comment about our overall economic impact. You have heard that from Chairman Thompson here. We have approximately 11,500 employees. We are Portland's largest business. We are the fourth largest business in the state. And our $1.2 billion annual operating budget, I think, is very important because of the multiplier effect it has on other activities in the state. And by the way, this is statewide, not only in the Portland metropolitan area. We have really been able to respond to, I think, a dramatically changed board, one that demands performance but is also proud of the job we do in terms of the human ROI that you've heard about as well. So I think this has been a relatively dramatic transformation that has occurred over a decade, and I think it's all the more remarkable if you consider the full history of our institution. I might mention to you that just as I was being recruited to Oregon, a bill was being introduced into the legislature here to close the OHSU hospital. They didn't tell me about that when I was being recruited, but I think you can see now that the hospital and clinical programs have provided a very important economic engine to our educational programs as well as to the state. With that, I'm pleased to turn this over to Provost Halleck.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Thank you. At some point in your presentation today or tomorrow,
If you could comment, please, on the legislative proposal to merge OHSU and Portland State University.
We would be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, President Kohler. For the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at OHSU, and I will be, emceeing the speakers that you will hear from today, and I will begin by discussing the mission and goals of OHSU and the educational mission in particular. Let me just quickly take you through the very large chunk of material that appears in front of you, just so you know what it is. You see that you have the testimony from Chair Thompson on top. There follows then two thick packets. These represent essentially a subset of the slides that are already in your book, but they are in the order of the presentation that we will be making to you. The first one is today's and the second one is tomorrow's, so they can just be put under tab one or follow along if you like, and we'll try and stick very closely to that script. Then there are a couple of other packets that instruct you at the top to insert them under tab six and tab ten. They're basically letters of support that have come in that we wanted to share with you. So if you simply put the one under tab 6 and the other at the back of tab 10, as it states, your notebooks will then be up to speed and up to date. Pause for a minute while everyone is doing that. And then we'll continue on, and most of you I saw have already seen that we're starting on that first packet, the first presentation, and we're now at page 6 of that first packet. The Oregon Health and Science University has a public and enterprise mission, and every 10 years we are accredited as a university. We're currently in the midst of that process, which involves approximately a two-year self-study, a sort of self-analysis, and as part of that you review your mission, you review your goals, and our faculty are in the midst of this. So we will probably emerge with a slightly modified mission statement, but the elements are clear and they look very much like the previous mission. I will point out one difference in that we have made more explicit some of the outcomes from the Oregon Opportunity Investment. We have continued, of course, the mission of education of the healthcare professionals and the biomedical research scientists. Because of the OGI merger, we are kind of expanding the way we characterize the mission to include health and well-being of citizens and not simply health, and because it now includes things like environmental health in terms of the engineering and research at Oregon Graduate Institute. But the main addition here that's new is to explicitly call out that we see it as part of our responsibility not only to conduct research in new discoveries and discovering new knowledge that improves health and well-being, but to actually facilitate the translation of these discoveries wherever we can into the health and commercial sectors. So spinning out companies in the biomedical device field, helping take a drug discovery to the bedside are part and parcel of our mission, and so we're so stating in a very explicit manner. We continue with the mission to provide high-quality health care, emphasizing that very environment. And finally, we see it as our responsibility to reach out into the community with all three of those missions, not just one of them, but with the education, the research, and the healthcare as broadly as we can possibly reach. Now, there's been, and I've met with some of you individually to try and go through some of this material. I apologize for the redundancy to those of you who've seen a couple of these slides before. This is a very simple graph of our revenue for the current fiscal year in an attempt to break out the different missions so that you can see how they are funded. And you can, again, red is the healthcare revenue, and that represents Medicaid, Medicare, Blue Cross, any kind of patient reimbursement. reimbursement, and therefore generally drives the hospital and clinic operations. The yellow represents research dollars, gifts, grants, and contracts that are earmarked specifically and legally for projects, often projects for which we've competed, but neither of those resources are fungible. If we moved research grants around and didn't do what we said we would do, we would be in a lot of trouble. In the case of patient care reimbursements, of course, you have to provide the patient care services. So that little blue-green circle in the upper right represents the educational mission. It is also where most of the state dollars that come to OHSU are spent, is in helping support the educational mission. Now, one exception to that is the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, and Dr. Rogers will tell you more about that tomorrow. But I want to point out the proportions in this little blue-green circle. The state represents about 31% of the educational mission, and tuition this year is about 33%. For those of you who have seen some of Oregon University System data, it's a very similar story. Tuition and the state are pretty much equal partners in supporting the educational mission. That third light blue triangle that's called grants is a bit of a catchment for scholarships, training grants from the federal government, gifts, anything we can find to help support the educational mission. That's how we make up the gap. Now, this slide, the government relations folks in the back of the room are groaning. I can hear them. They think it's way too busy for me to share. But I think if you just look at the colors, if you're not colorblind, it's sort of helpful because the circles at the right are yellow. They are research institutes. They're funded by research grants, and that's their primary role at OHSU. The hospital down in the bottom is obviously funded by patient revenue, and the little one to the right of the hospital, the Child Development and Rehabilitation Center, you can see has many colors, and you'll hear more about that. It delivers patient care, but it also conducts research and trains individuals to care for these children. But the schools, which are sort of off the slide, which is not intentional to the deans in the room, are over to the left, and you can see that the schools also have a multifaceted mission. They have grants. They have the yellow component, they conduct research, but they also are heavily dependent on the state dollars to conduct their educational mission and on tuition to do so. If you take the grants out, and as I said, you can't really do anything with the grants except conduct the research for which they're intended, you can see that the schools over in the left are, in fact, about a third, again, funded by the state to deliver their educational mission. That's an misunderstood element of OHSU's budget, and perhaps we haven't done as good a job as we should of it trying to help people understand what it is that the state supports and how we use those dollars very directly. The upper left corner shows the rural health educational outreach programs and the clinical technical support. You'll be hearing from Karen Whitaker later on today, and you may have noticed in the previous slide there's tremendous leverage in those programs of federal dollars to help assist in that mission. The state then, to summarize, really the state dollars are used to train the tomorrow's healthcare providers and scientists to conduct the community outreach programs, and more recently the Oregon Poison Center, and as you may know, in the governor's recommended budget, that in fact was recommended for funding, and the uncompensated care mission at OHSU. Over the past several biennia, that support has eroded significantly, and we struggle with that, and we will address that kind of in an ongoing fashion in the next 2 days as to how we're handling that and how we're prioritizing the uncompensated care that we are able to provide. The state appropriation since the biennium leading up to the public corporation is depicted in this graph, and I think you can see these are absolute dollars. There's no inflationary adjustment on this graph. So I think you can see that we have become less dependent overall on the state appropriation, but those educational programs, as you could see in the previous slide, still remain extremely dependent to deliver that educational mission, as does the CDRC, the Child Development Rehabilitation Center, to deliver certain kinds of services. The recommended budget from the governor is on the far right, and that little orange stripe is the Poison Center recommendation. We've added, at the request of the co-chair and others, the debt service on the Oregon Opportunity in gray on this slide, so that you can see that there is debt service that is being covered by the state as well for that one-time investment of the bonds in the Oregon Opportunity, and you'll hear more about the deliverance, what we've delivered on those bonds and the economic engine that they have become tomorrow from President Kohler. When we looked, and I'm going to say a little something about setting priorities in the budget climate in which we sit right now, to set the stage for the speakers that are coming, we're going to focus on the impacts of the budget and the budget reductions at the end of tomorrow. But we have people here today to talk about specific programs, the Dean of Nursing, the Director of the CDRC beginning tomorrow, the Director of the Rural Health Programs. And because they'll be talking about their programs, they'll also be talking about performance measures and impacts. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about how we've prioritized just at a very high level to set the stage for that. We'll come back to this tomorrow. As I've just mentioned, the grants and contracts we receive have to be used to deliver the projects that we promise to deliver. Patient care similarly has constraints. The other thing that's often misunderstood about our budget is the distinction between capital budgets and operating budgets. I know you understand that in your roles, but it's not a commonly understood issue, and we have bonds, both our own revenue bonds that we've obtained from the market and the Oregon Opportunity bonds, all constrained for capital, so they can be used for construction, they can be used for one-time investments of major equipment, but they can't be used for operating in any way. That's part of the bond covenants, and they are, the covenant that you reach with the bond holders is that you will spend them specifically on these capital projects. Generally, they're projects that will allow you to generate revenue to pay the bonds back. That's usually how that they are obtained. When we looked at the reductions in the recommended budget, and when we look in general at aligning our budget with our revenue, just like you would in any budget, in this particular round, the recommendation is for a 40% reduction in the operating budget. When you have that kind of reduction, it really forces you to take stock of your core mission and figure out what is at the heart of what we do and only we do that we can't fail to deliver. And the first decision we made was that the thing we wanted to protect first and foremost was the core infrastructure of the three health professional schools. Now, I'm not saying a great deal about the Oregon Graduate Institute here because there is no state money that flows into that institute. It essentially operates as a private school inside our context. And so I will mention it when I talk about the educational mission because it's very germane to both our research and educational richness, but there's no state dollars that flow into OGI. So I mainly will focus on nursing, dentistry, and medicine when I talk about the core infrastructure of our schools. Another option would have been to close a school. I mean, that would have been one way to handle a 40% reduction. We are not recommending that. We are trying to sustain the core of what an academic health center is and can deliver given the workforce shortages we see coming and given the quality of the programs that we've been able to grow. We also obviously have to preserve the ability to generate enough revenue to stay afloat. It won't do us any good if we kill the engine in the process of this protection of the core because we won't be able to sustain the institution. And finally, in those two contexts, with that framework, every decision is that we made where we had the choice, we've tried to optimize the care for the most vulnerable populations. And I think you'll see as we go through these things the examples of that. And another view of that kind of protection really can be seen in the educational program. One of the things that we think it's very important to do is to deliver, is to try and help individuals who want careers in the health professions to access them. And that can be done by a subsidized tuition rate. It can also be done with scholarships and loan forgiveness programs that help distribute those providers. There are a lot of mechanisms to do that. But without some mechanism to do that, you really do reduce access to those professions at a time when they're badly needed. In terms of the goals, they really follow these missions very, very closely. Our goal is pretty audacious. We think all our academic programs ought to be in the top 10. That's the goal for all of our academic programs. Many of them are. Not all of them are, and we want them to strive to be there, and you'll hear specifics about that as we go along. We would like to be ranked in the top 20 in NIH, National Institutes of Health, funded research programs. Why that goal? The NIH grants that we obtain are not given to us by a process of gift. They're given to us by a peer-reviewed process. Our investigators have to go into a pot where other investigators just like them judge them, rank them, and then the top 10% of the approved projects about are funded. So the rankings in NIH dollars are very, very important national metrics for the quality of your research program, as opposed to some kinds of internal subsidies. And for the last 15 years, we've been very rigorous about not allowing research programs to be funded on institutional resources that couldn't compete on that national market. If you can provide the infrastructure for these researchers, they, if they're of sufficient quality, should be able to compete to bring in the grant dollars. And that's how we've driven that, and that's one of the reasons for this goal. And then in terms of the educational programs, of course, you want to bring in the best material possible. You want to bring in the most qualified applicants that you can possibly bring, and you'll see from our performance measures how we measure some of that. And then you want to have an output that's commensurate with that quality. You want to produce the best physicians, nurses, scientists, engineers, allied health professionals. And how do we judge that? In some ways, it's a little easier for us than it is for an undergraduate university, because we have licensure as the end product of a lot of our programs, and how they do on those licensure exams gives us a measure of how well they've learned the material. We can also look at their employers and the traditional ways you measure graduates and their contributions. And finally, we want to provide health care, and the provision of health care itself is part of our mission, and of course we want that to be of the highest quality. And there are ways you can measure that. There are all kinds of quality assurance metrics as well as satisfaction surveys of patients, and you'll see a bit of that as we go through this. What I'd like to leave you with, and then I'm going to go very briefly through the history, is the sense that the environment in which we conduct our educational mission is one of intense research and discovery and intense healthcare delivery. And that very environment trains students in the most effective way possible. When a student graduates, a few years after they graduate, a lot of the specific facts that they learn are no longer as relevant as they were the day they learned them, and new information's come along. So if you train them in an environment where that new information is coming and they have to learn how to assimilate it and make practice decisions in that environment and interpret new information, you have trained a better healthcare professional. And there's no better way to do that than in the context of delivering healthcare. So part of the reason for those missions is that it's a better educational environment. Part of it is that they have value in and of themselves. I think I'll pause for just a moment and see if you want to ask any questions, or maybe you'll just interrupt me if you do, before I start in on a little bit of historical context.
Yes. Representative Jensen.
In your goals and mission, you're making statements about where you want to be. Want to be ranked in the top 20, funded by NIH, and some others in terms of first-time pass rates, etc. I'd be interested in where are we?
And I can address that now, or as you'll see, we have a lot of metrics as we come
if
to
it's
the
coming. That's fine.
It is, and probably more detailed than you want, but we have a lot of performance measures as we come to the specifics. I'm not going to go through all the items on the historical perspective. I put the slides in there in case you're interested. The point of the first one is that we actually have private origins. The schools that started were private, but we also have public origins. The First People's Institute and Free Dispensary affiliated with the medical school in 1910. It was an environment in which our medical students could learn, and eventually, as you'll see, it moved to the Hill. So we have both private and public origins as in our past, and gradually the move to the Hill occurred, and I won't retell the story of how that occurred unless someone's interested afterwards, but we landed on the Hill for very peculiar reasons, and in 1920, this is what OHSU, how it would appear if you were in the air. In the early part of the 20th century, a campus began to emerge from the Markham Hill, and the original School of Medicine was part of the University of Oregon and gradually added additional subject matter. The PhDs were first added in 1934 in the basic sciences that are related to medicine. The library was constructed as a part of the Depression era construction projects, and in the mid-40s, we began to construct across the canyon, as we call it, who live on the hill. And in that period from 1940 to 1960, we really began to come into our own as an academic health center with nursing, dentistry, and medicine, which had been there originally when Senator Hatfield was governor. The dental school really became part of OHSU, actually, when he was in the assembly. And the Child Development Rehabilitation Center moved there. So that's really when it started to take the character of an academic health center. This happens to be the construction of the dental school in 1954. It was just when we started building things in the air and on the sides of hills to make it all fit. In 1974, we became a freestanding university and no longer schools of the University of Oregon and Eugene. We became the eighth institution in the higher ed system and took on a name that in those days was becoming popular for academic health centers, the University of Oregon Health Sciences Center. It was later changed to OHSU, Oregon Health Sciences Center University, partly out of confusion with the University of Oregon and to clarify the independent role. The addition of some research buildings continued the development of the Academic Health Center campus, and in the 1980 to 2000 period, tremendous growth occurred in the research mission, and various research institutes were merged, and the public corporation was formed. And you can see three cranes there in the construction of some of those research and healthcare facilities. I want to pause for just a moment and just touch a little bit more on the public corporation. President Kohler alluded to this, but for those of you who weren't part of that process, we faced some tremendous challenges in the late 80s that were largely driven by managed care and the kind of the reimbursement structures that were part of the healthcare system. And across the country, there were various experiments going on. Hospitals were spinning out of academic health centers, they were spending into academic health centers. There were a variety of models being tried, some more successful than the other. We spent 5 years really looking at how we could operate more effectively. And starting in 1990 and culminating in the legislative session in 1995, when we brought to the legislature the proposal for the public corporation, we looked at everything from a private, completely private, or a 501c3 model to something like merging with the health division and becoming a complete state agency. We landed on the public corporation, which is really a creature of statute. It retained the public mission to the extent that there was a partnership with the state and others to conduct it, and we also gained a board that was appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and focused on OHSU and its missions. It gave us the flexibility to operate much more efficiently and to make decisions promptly and to enter into business partnerships and relationships and educational partnerships, and basically made us more nimble, if you can call an institution our size nimble. The Senate Bill 2 was the vehicle for this change. It's now ORS 353 and provided us with a fairly standard public governance structure, but one that's focused very much on the academic health center mission. We continue a very strong relationship with the Oregon University System. I've remained a member of their academic council, now called the Provost Council, since 1989. Our degree granting programs goes through that process of quality assurance and approval. We could elect to do it differently. We need to stay coordinated with them, but we have, at least to date, opted to do it this way because it promotes the coordination and the interaction that helps us. We have very complementary but almost entirely non-overlapping degrees and programs, but we do have some joint programs with the OUS institution, and one of our board members overlaps with the OUS board. So there's one board member, it currently is Director Kirby Dias, who's a member of both boards. This is the institution today, and as you can see, we've started filling in the canyon. A lot of this really growth really took place since 1995, since the public corporation occurred. One of the first things we were able to do was construct a new mother-baby unit in the hospital that had been pending for 8 years before the public corporation. We weren't asking for money to do it, just the approval to do it, and we were able to construct it promptly, and that's now a premier place for both compensated and uncompensated care for delivery. There are new constructions from the Oregon Opportunity Bonds. You'll be hearing about that, and new patient care facilities. And I think it's under construction, and I've talked to some of you about this. You've talked to many of us. One of the bonds are used to construct these buildings. It gives us increased capacity to provide both compensated and uncompensated care. And as you undoubtedly are aware, the Schnitzers have very generously donated land to allow us to construct a campus once we're able to raise money to do so. This is probably in the 5 to 10 year range, but the ability to connect with the streetcar with Portland State and via a tram to the Hill will allow us to connect both the healthcare mission and the academic educational mission as we go forward. Now, what I'd like to do is pause for a second and then really enter into the specifics of our educational programs.
Dr. Halleck, I had a couple of questions, and I'm going to ask them because they haven't been asked yet, actually, because I feel kind of, as the chair of the committee, that I should put some questions on the record that have come to me from other parties. Clearly, I understand that you cannot use any of the capital funds for any operating purpose, and clearly I understand that much of your research dollars cannot be used for any to serve any direct educational component of your institutions. How would you differ? I'll use the School of Nursing as an example, because that's probably the most classic example, where some nonprofit hospitals, both in Oregon and in other states, will either have a School of Nursing within the hospital, or they will have a School of Nursing where part of the undergraduate credits come from another university, and a student goes on to the and basically works in the hospital for a couple of years and has programs there that they go through. Do those entities subsidize those programs with patient dollars, or do they not? That's the first question.
Sure.
And the second question is probably beyond the purview of this committee, and it's the issue that you've brought up, but it's a significant issue, and that is the issue of, since you are, in a sense, the indigent care provider of last resort, and because of that you actually provide far more indigent care than other hospitals in the metropolitan area, what might you suggest that would be possible to spread that to spread that burden broader within the medical community than just OHSU?
Let me tackle the first one first. And fortunately, Dean Potempa just came up to the podium. Kate Potempa is the Dean of Nursing at OHSU, so I'll give you a general answer and let her talk specifically about the nursing programs. In general, the educational programs that sit inside a health system, like a hospital or an academic health center, do rely on that environment for their patient care, their direct, we call them clerkships, or their experiential training. And there is a cross-subsidy in that it takes time of these providers to provide that kind of mentoring and that kind of care. But the cross-subsidy that comes in a more direct way in OHSU is really from the health system to the School of Nursing and to the School of Medicine. And in the case of the School of Medicine, the faculty there are, in fact, the physicians that provide the care in the hospital. They're paid for that, and that payment goes into a practice plan that's really a separate nonprofit. Those physicians put almost 30% of the income they receive back into the institution to support the educational mission. So out of their pockets, essentially, they are supporting what they call the dean's tax, and they are, in fact, supporting the educational mission of the school, but also of their own departmental programs. In the case of nursing, the hospital also does help support that educational mission to the extent it can, depending on its financial health. But there's also the environmental question. In most systems, they don't directly transfer dollars, but they do provide a venue in which the students can train. Kate, you want to?
Sure. My name is Kate Potempa. I'm dean of the School of Nursing at OHSU. At OHSU on the Portland campus, we have a great interchange with the hospital. Many of the managers, from the chief nurse executive down to the unit manager, our School of Nursing faculty. And so in that capacity, they also provide leadership and training of students. And so there is that bit of exchange and overlap similar to the medical school because of the environment. Other arrangements around the state in the southern region is we have some joint appointments where our faculty also work in the hospital around the state where we have partnerships, and there's that kind of overlap. That's very typical in terms of wanting to have benefits from both systems and partnerships working together.
The second question you can either answer today or answer tomorrow or in phase two, but it probably is beyond the purview of this committee in terms of policy.
Well,
rather than a budget issue, but it is a significant issue, I know.
Absolutely, and we would love to try and answer it. We actually have planned to address it tomorrow. We talk about healthcare delivery, if that's all right with
yes,
the committee, because I think it's an incredibly critical question for society and for Oregon. And we have some suggestions. We don't have the total answer, certainly, for all uncompensated care.
Representative Winston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Provost, I have a bill that I'm introducing on behalf of a doctor in the Bend area, and I think we've talked about this when I visited the campus. Mr. Chair, part of the problem is the medical. My constituent that asked me to introduce this bill, we're asking that when he's treating Oregon Health Plan patients, that he be covered by the state insurance. And at first he wanted to be able, because he's treating more than 60% of his patients are Oregon Health Plan patients, he was asking could he be covered under the state insurance policy. And now the latest proposal in the bill we have in says during when he's treating those patients could he be covered, because it's a liability issue. And maybe that would also apply to hospitals like St. Charles and things like that they could treat more. We're fortunate in the Bend area, we have the Volunteers in Medicine Clinic that's really helping tremendously in the people that cannot afford medical care. It's all being done by doctors and nurses volunteering their time. But so we can maybe talk about that later, but that's...
And I think you'll hear when we talk about rural health outreach another sort of aspect of that in terms of the insurance and the liability issues and suggestions that might be an option.
Representative March and then Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dean Halleck, you mentioned the figure 40% reduction. And how did you arrive at that figure? And
right, in the operating budget. And I want to be very respectful here of the whole budget. There are several aspects to it. There's the debt service, which really isn't in our budget. It's in the state's budget on the Oregon Opportunity Bonds. The recommended budget amount is $53 million as compared to $85 million for the current biennium. It's approximately 38%. if in fact you take the poison center, and I'm sure you hear these discussions all the time, the poison center, which is a mandate in the budget, one we applaud, it's a wonderful service, then you're left with $50.7 million, which is about 40% of our current appropriation for operations. So that's how we come to that.
Okay, so beyond just the university side of it, the full operations?
The operation of OHSU as a whole as funded by the state. So it's really that reduction to 50.3 from the 85.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you come back tomorrow to help us with the discussion around how we spread the burden of indigent care across other hospitals, other institutions, would you also please talk to this committee about what role we might play in helping to shift the discussion in a way that makes something meaningful happen. This is a huge issue. It is a huge burden. I'm interested in hearing what discussions are taking place out there amongst the various hospitals around this subject. How do we shift from where we are now to some collaboration, some partnership, and what role might we play as a, not just as an education committee, but as a legislator, as a convener?
We'll address that in our preparing material in response to a question that you had posed to us in an earlier visit that we'll bring tomorrow as well.
Thank you.
Continue.
Yes, please proceed.
We're going to talk a little bit about the specific educational programs that the state helps fund. And I want to make one point first, and I apologize for the faintness of the color on this graph, but I think it's in your book, and I don't know if it reproduced in black and white, but it really is a very simple context that I want to set. We're all getting older. Well, maybe some of you aren't, but many of us are, and the number of people who will be over 65 is about to increase precipitously, and that's that upturn in that graph. We're pretty much at the bottom of that very steep slope. The other aspect of aging is that people spend more time getting health care. And the curve on the right represents days of time spent in a hospital. It happens to be per 1,000 population, but it's really utilization of inpatient services as a function of age. And you can see on the left side, a lot of babies are born in hospitals, so there's a little upswing there. But basically, if you look at the bottom, if you can read it, it starts up when you reach 65 or thereabouts. And so if you combine these two plus the growth of the population, you can see that we're facing a tremendous health care need. And one of the points I want to leave you with is that most people are aware now that we're in a nursing shortage. We're at the beginning of what looks to be a very critical nursing shortage. But we're also facing critical shortages in other health care areas. We have been producing the same number of physician graduates in this country for 30 years. And there's nothing on the slate that would change that right now if we don't take some action. We're not asking you to do anything about that this session. You have enough problems this session, but what we really want you to understand is that it's not just a nursing shortage, it's a shortage in all manner of healthcare professionals that we're beginning to tackle. We're looking for creative ways to teach more productively. You'll hear a couple of examples of that. Ways to teach in an interdisciplinary fashion so students are ready to go to work as part of a team the minute they graduate. A host of things that make us more effective, but we take this very seriously because we know that it takes 10 years to train many healthcare professionals. We have to start now to address this coming kind of need. And so that's the context in which we deliver our educational mission. The OHSU, you heard some of the metrics. We have specific enrollment charts. If you'd like them, I can give them to you. And you'll hear a little bit more specifically about the School of Nursing. We also have nearly 1,000 trainees. These are postdocs, residents in the hospital, trainees in the CDRC learning how to take care of kids with special health care needs. That's an important part of our mission. They don't obtain a degree at the end of that, but they obtain very specific training that's critical to what they will do next. We also have joint degrees. The pharmacy degree, the PharmD degree, is a joint degree with OSU. They spend the first 2 years of that program on the Corvallis campus at OSU and the last two in Portland on the OHSU campus. Allied health programs increasingly are in partnership with Oregon Institute of Technology. Right now, the medical technology, now they call it clinical laboratory science, and the emergency medicine technology are joint degrees with really operated administratively by OIT, and they're operated in both Klamath Falls and Portland. The CLS, the medical technology, is actually on our campus, the OIT program that we operate jointly, and the emergency medicine technology program is a wonderful success story. That was the budget for that was reduced in the last round of budget reductions. We formed a partnership with OIT and the Tualatin Valley Fire District. We actually trained those students in their facility for no charge. In exchange, two slots in each class are reserved for their firemen and women if they qualify for otherwise for admissions in exchange. And it's a marvelous facility, and it's a three-way partnership. We have a 500-seater, 400-seat auditorium for a class of 20. They fill that when they graduate with their fire departments and their friends and their families. It's an incredible program and an example of the kinds of partnerships we're trying to form. There's some metrics in here, and I'll come to performance metrics at the end of this session, so I don't want to belabor them, that give you some of the answers to the question from Representative Jensen. We look at applicant pools. We look at overall GPA of incoming students, and we are consistently in the top 10 in the dental school in those metrics. Our applicant pools are phenomenal in all three of these schools. We had 816 applications for 75 spots in the dental school this past year, and these students all pass with a phenomenal pass rate. Their licensure exams, they are superb clinicians. You may not be aware that we have a clinic, a dental clinic, that sees 80,000 patients a year, or there are 80,000 visits a year. We charge about half of the market rate, so it's an opportunity for individuals, if they're willing to be a little patient with a student learner and a dentist who mentors that student. So it sometimes takes a little longer, but they're overseen by superb practitioners to obtain dental care. And in fact, in that context, we also have funds from the Oregon Dental Association to help reimburse families with low income for their children's dental care. And you'll hear this children theme on the uncompensated care discussion tomorrow. You may recall that we were, during the Measure 5 reductions in the early 90s, we actually closed the pediatric dentistry residency program. I'm very happy to indicate that we are managing to restart that now with no additional state funds, but with some federal funds and some private donations. So that will be starting. There's a tremendous shortage of pediatric dentists in this state.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lindsay, when I toured up there, we talked about how old the dental school is. And is later in the testimony that you're going to present, can you tell us or give us an idea of how, you know, are we too small? I mean, is there a scale of economy there that we're only teaching 75? Is that something we maybe need to look at if we don't have the facilities? You know, what's the average size or
right.
University, dental school, or whatever? If you could do that later.
Or I can actually address it now because the answer is fairly simple. Yes, is the answer. We are too small. There are half a dozen surrounding states without dental schools. The demographic needs in dentistry are just as sharp as they are in nursing, and the aging dental workforce is upon us. We are absolutely constrained by chairs in the dental school. It's a very facility-driven investment. As we look to the River Campus and what we call the Schnitzer Campus and its development out in the future, one of the things we want to do, and we have discussions underway with some of these states that don't have dental schools, is really have them help invest in that new facility. We do need a new facility. It's 50 years old. It's in. It's just beyond its useful life. And so part of our thinking is that it needs to be expanded, but with investments from others who might need the products of our graduates, of our school. So yes, we could expand it. There are some economies of scale, but the ratio, it's a very hands-on kind of profession, and the ratio of teachers to students is critical. We are right at the bottom of the accreditation ratio that's allowed, and yet we are accredited with very high marks. They work very hard, these faculty. If we expand, we will have to hire more faculty is kind of the conclusion from that. But it is doable, and if we had the facilities, we could easily expand.
Just a quick follow-on, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That sounds good. I think that's what, like we've talked about this on the visit, and that we, you know, maybe that's what we need. Anything the legislature can do to help that make a regional. I noticed the dental school started off with a combination of a school from Washington and Oregon. So maybe we need, now Washington State has a dental school, right? But you're looking at Idaho or something like
that. Right, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana. And so we are looking at that. And we also are in a private campaign through the foundation beginning to raise money for a new facility. We have a long ways to go, but that's another part of that strategy. I want to say a word or... Did I answer your question?
And then Senator Gordley has...
Actually, my question was answered in your comments back to Representative Wisnot, having to do with capacity and need, and you addressed that. Thank you.
Thank you. Medical Please school, you may be aware, has been ranked second 4 years in a row in primary care in national survey reported by U.S. News & World Report on graduate programs. A big part of that is our rural program. The infrastructure of the area health education centers and the rural health infrastructure support we provide as part of how we're able to move medical students into rural communities as part of their training. Every medical student has mandatory rural rotations. We would like to have more of them. We'd like a special track. We're calling it the Oregon Scholar or the Rural Scholar program, where if a student so elected, they can spend a substantial amount of their time training in rural areas. It really gives them a sense of what kind of practice that would be, what kind of lifestyle that would be. Some of them love it, some of them don't. Either way, it's a good experience and a good way of deciding how you want to spend your time. We graduate a lot more practitioners who go into fields like that than most medical schools because of that kind of program. We also have an enormous applicant pool, very high qualified. I've given you the statistic here for last year. We have over 3,600 this year in the current decision-making process. It's painful, in fact, to have that wonderful an applicant pool because you're turning away, of course, very highly qualified people. And in a time when Oregon trains half the per capita of physicians in the country, of the national average, they're surrounded states without medical schools. So again, it's a capacity question. We're looking to decentralize and create community-based clerkships and training opportunities. We're in conversations with Peace Health and University of Oregon in terms of putting a pod of medical students, a cohort of medical students there. We're in conversations with other health systems around the state for other possible arrangements. So we're looking at decentralizing some of the training, not all of it. Some of it has to be done in the academic health center, but some of it can be done in other health systems. They're interested because they see the shortage coming and they want to participate in the training and, of course, then recruit some of those graduates.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. I have a question in response to that. If you decentralize the training, will that give you more than 108 slots?
Yes, absolutely. That would be the goal. The conversations we've just begun with the University of Oregon and Peace Health, for example, contemplates a cohort of 30, maybe eventually 60, as many as 60 additional students, but initially we're thinking 20 to 30, that might spend possibly their first and their third year in Eugene. Now, why first and third? The first has a lot of basic science in it. There's some superb basic science, obviously, at the University of Oregon. There's some good overlap there in terms of what we could accomplish. The second year's harder. There's a lot of pathophysiology, a lot of disease mechanisms, a lot of things that our clinicians teach. So we're thinking we might have to bring them back and make sure we have the capacity to handle that. But in the third and fourth year, they're out in clinics. They're training in healthcare settings. And some of those, again, could be distributed, and that would enhance the capacity. So that's one of the reasons we're looking at it. And we're also just beginning those discussions in other communities. So yes is the answer.
I think that's great because 108 is not very many.
It is not.
We've got over 3,000 athletes.
Absolutely. We could, if we had the capacity, and again, it becomes a ratio of faculty to students, mm-hmm. and these faculty support themselves, of course, with the few education dollars they have, but also earning a living, and that limits, because we don't give them very much of their salary, and so that gives them a limited amount of time, and we pushed them. It's really remarkable over the last two decades how the faculty have stepped up to the plate, but if we're going to increase the class size, we have to increase the faculty base to, mm-hmm. to be able to do that. The other metrics for medicine are the residency programs, and it's very critical that you understand that's a huge role that we play. Physicians, after they graduate, spend 3 to 4 years in residency programs, and they nationally seek out training at OHSU, particularly in the primary care areas, but in many of the specialty areas as well. And I think I'll stop right here and let Dean Potempa talk about nursing, and then I'll come back to some of the specific performance measures that we use to look at how we're doing in the educational sector. So I'm going to skip ahead here a couple of slides.
Okay. And Dr. Halleck, if you can kind of work with me on this in our final 50 minutes so we can get through your day one presentation and I believe you're doing that right now, trying to skip through a few slides.
Right.
So we have about 50 minutes to get through day one, and we've got a very packed day two also.
And you're right. That's exactly what I just did, and we'll do. We have constructed it so that if we need to overlap on the rural health a little bit into tomorrow, we can manage the time, I think. But thank you for being mindful of that.
All right. Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, again, I'm Kathleen Potempa. I'm Dean of the School of Nursing at OHSU. The first slide here highlights aspects of the School of Nursing that I think make it a unique asset to Oregon. It is a top-ranked school. It has been a top-ranked school for more than 10 years. By the top parameters used nationally, the amount of dollars from the National Institutes of Health, we ranked 8th in 2003, and U.S. News and World Report, I want to go down to the very bottom dash, which says 6th overall. What that means is the OHSU School of Nursing is ranked 6th in the country of all schools of nursing in the country. It is a very prestigious honor. It is based on the rankings of virtually all our graduate programs, and rankings are done on the basis of graduate programs.
Sure.
This is
Representative Jensen has
just a very quick sort of thing. Where do you rank in the School of Psychiatric Nursing?
Psychiatric nursing is also ranked in the top 10. I believe it's 8th or 9th.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you. I'd like to point out that we are 4 campuses that also have outreach sites from those campuses. We have a campus in Portland, on Eastern Oregon University campus in LeGrand, Oregon Institute of Technology in Klamath Falls, and Southern Oregon University in Ashland. These are strong partnerships for us, and I'd like you to refer you to the letters of support under tab 10. That were written by the presidents of those respective OUS universities, which really speak to their understanding and appreciation of the partnership that we bring jointly with them to expand education. I think they highlight the value of having the quality of faculty that OHSU brings in partnership with their faculty. As most of you know, we are in a very serious nurse shortage, but also a very serious faculty shortage. And one of the things that we do is bring this top faculty to rural as well as urban areas of the state. We are a magnet, if you will, for some of the top faculty nationally. We also want to highlight that we have many, many applicants for the positions that we have. We've been emphasizing the undergraduate program because of the shortage of staff nurses, but we also have held steady in terms of our graduate program enrollments. Next slide. Some of the benchmarks that I'd like to emphasize is that we have a high pass rate for the National Licensing Examination. We do have innovative programs for graduate students. There is a severe shortage of faculty across the country, and particularly in the Northwest. And we've been able to sustain this program through federal grants, and I'm going to talk a bit about that further on. One of the things that a top 10 faculty can do is to leverage dollar-for-dollar state funding to bring in external support for the various programs. And these dollars, you'll see $54 million has been brought in by the School of Nursing faculty over the last decade. And this has supported both educational practice and research expansion for rural as well as urban areas of the state. The School of Nursing, for example, manages three rural clinics in eastern Oregon that take care of over 800 citizens in the most rural parts of eastern Oregon every year, and operates five-county health network for rural schools that sees over 2,000 school children a year in those five counties. That's just one example of the clinical programs that we have. We, in fact, have one of the largest clinical programs of any school in the country. I also will highlight for you the Oregon Nursing Education Consortium, the OCNE, that many of you may have heard about. OHSU School of Nursing has been pivotal to that effort, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. That is a partnership between OHSU School of Nursing community colleges and partner OUS institutions. I want to emphasize the leveraging that a top 10 faculty can provide and why that's important to the state of Oregon. And this slide just shows you that we received over the decade approximately $52 million in state funding. And we leveraged that to more than dollar for dollar expansion of external funding. This external funding, for example, started the clinics in eastern Oregon and sustained them for a number of years. It started the Health Network for Rural Schools and is sustaining it to this day, these federal and foundation grants. And it's because of the prestige of the faculty that impresses the grantees, the grantors, rather, at the federal government. It has supported the expansion of our programs throughout the state, and I'll show you a slide of that in just a moment. Educationally, it's allowed us to educate psychiatric nurse practitioners, for example, in the rural areas of the state. We have a five-year grant to do so. It's allowed us to educate family nurse practitioners around the state. All of that we would not otherwise be able to do if we could not leverage the state dollars to get us this amount of federal and external funding. Next slide. This is a picture of the outreach sites that OHSU School of Nursing has, and you'll see that each campus serves as a hub for surrounding areas. And how important those hubs are to supporting the various regions of the state, and how we can leverage this engine that we have to the benefit of the various communities in the state. This slide really illustrates the perfect storm, as some have called it, on the shortage of nursing projected from the year 2000 all the way out to 2010. Now, we now know that these are conservative figures, but we used conservative figures to project the needs out to 2010, which is the red line. The blue line is really what is happening due to retirements and the aging workforce in nursing. The average age of the practicing nurse is 47 years. The average age of a faculty member is 53 years. Roughly 30 years ago, a significant proportion of nurses were under age 30. Now, only a very small percentage of nurses are under age 30. So this really illustrates the impending storm that we are experiencing. The dashed green line is what happens if we double enrollment.
I'm curious,
Mr. Chairman,
about this age issue as far as nurses are concerned. And having taught at a community college, albeit one of the small ones with not a large nursing program, but nevertheless a nursing program. And my observation is that this has been, in many of these programs, non-traditional students, the reentry. And is that part of what is contributing to this aging of the nursing population, or is that an anomaly?
Well, I think you raise a very good point, Representative Jensen. That is part of the issue, that over the last 15 to 20 years, an emphasis was nationally on the reentry of women and others into the workforce, which was wonderful, but nonetheless, it does shorten the trajectory of their work life in terms of longevity. The issue is we need a balance, and we need to have younger as well people of all ages entering the workforce.
Mr. Chair, I'm obviously not proposing that we do that. It's just an inquiry as to what is any contribution that it's making to the problems we're dealing with in the future.
Yes.
An additional thing that you could comment on, actually, relative to this, is that it was your previous slide. You had 800 and some applicants for about one-eighth of that number of positions.
Yes.
And I know that the previous year, a different nursing program, obviously, but the PCC had about 1,000 applicants for 100 positions also. Out of your 800 applicants plus, you had to select who you thought was the most qualified for your program. But wouldn't you say that the vast majority of those applicants who desired to get into nursing programs were qualified to enter into programs?
Yes, Chairman Devlin, thank you. We believe most of them are qualified with GPAs greater than 2.5, which is the bottom level, with the right prerequisites. They're very talented applicants. This year, actually, for our applicant pool right now for next fall is close to 1,000 for roughly the same number of slots. We admitted last year, because of this enormous number of qualified applicants, an extra cohort of students on our Portland campus, as well as a few more in our Eastern campus. We admitted 70 students mid-year in January because of the severe shortage and the number of qualified applicants.
So, in other words, we could probably we've discussed this issue before in the committee, but it's pretty clear that part of the problem in terms of aging is the fact that we don't have enough slots available for people to train in this profession, and that we could resolve part of that position if we had more slots available for qualified students.
Yes.
So,
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Wisner.
Thank you. Based upon your previous experience in this question, did we look at two-shift classes, and is it a problem with instructors, or is it facilities, or only? I'm sure.
Probably a little bit of both. I think the dean would.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Wisner. It's all of that. And I'm going to talk next about the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education, which actually addressed the factors that have led to this perfect storm, and this is the solution that has come forward from virtually all the major constituencies in nursing and major health care. It's been endorsed by the leaders of the community colleges, by the leaders, our OUS partners, by certainly OHSU faculty, as well as health care executives, as being the solution, which recognizes our need to leverage the core programs that we have in the face of a significant faculty shortage, to leverage through changing our educational model to focus more on simulation to allow us to expand the clinical experiences with what we call preclinical learning, making the clinical education richer and able to be more focused and intense through immersions in the junior and senior year. As well as to leverage faculty in partnership with OHSU. The Oregon Consortium of Nursing Education, called the OCNE, is a voluntary partnership among community colleges and universities in Oregon. OHSU is the principal public-supported institution for the upper division nursing coursework. Collaborating to accomplish mutual objectives in nursing education statewide, forming one curriculum that will be leveraged on the various on the campuses of the community colleges. Note the letters of support under tab 10 from Louise Shores, who is the OCNE coordinator. The various presidents and directors of community colleges who are supportive of OHSU and our program and partnerships, as well as, again, the OUS presidents and the healthcare CEOs and vice presidents of nursing who are waiting for the graduates of this program. There's been a huge national conversation about the healthcare needs of the future and the shortages of the health professions, including nursing, and the Institute of Medicine, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, the national professional organizations all speak to the increasing complexity of care, the increasing technology, the aging population with the complexity of comorbidities, and the need for higher educated nurses at the bedside as well as in education, and all of those letters speak to that and the support of this curriculum. The Nursing Consortium goals are to increase access to and speed of progression in nursing education, provide seamless academic progression across consortium institutions, improve quality through standardized competencies and curriculum, and leverage and share training resources across partner programs. The mechanisms that we are actively engaged in developing are interinstitutional agreements supporting dual enrollments, particularly between community college and OHSU, common transcript and financial aid packages. One of the big barriers for students continuing their education is financial aid, and there are some agencies which prohibit students to get significant financial aid once they've received a first professional degree, even if that was at an associate degree level. Common competencies and curriculum, joint appointment of faculty across institutions where appropriate, again, to leverage and support capacity building. Distance delivery of upper division courses by OHSU to partner institutions. This slide shows the consortium partners, and you'll see that we have a number of partners from the community colleges in the first wave. In fact, we have more wanting to be in the first wave than we can than we probably can handle, so we're holding them into waves, and because of the enthusiasm of our partner institutions around the state to join into this effort.
Question.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
It seems to me that in the case of Blue Mountain, which I'm familiar with, that they have a clinical shortage of hospitals or clinical settings. And I think they've gone across the border to some of the neighborhood in Washington. Is that common to the, I think I see on, is that Ontario there? Not blurry for me, but some of the other community colleges in away from the metro area.
Yes, that is true.
Okay. Thank you.
Please proceed.
I'd like to...
That's all.
Pursuing sites for clinical training is kind of a major focus of any of these programs. It's a huge effort and a critical one. I have provided for you a number of performance measures in the material. These were also in the book, but just pulled them together here for your convenience. I don't need to belabor them, but I'm happy to address any and whatever detail you like. I will draw your attention to a couple, but I want to leave some time for the rural health programs unless you have specific questions.
Chair. Yes, Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Devlin, Ms. Halleck, have you, I'm sure you have, but could you address with the committee the possibilities that are out there to partner with various hospitals in getting private scholarships for nursing students and perhaps even getting some grants from the various different hospitals to help expand those programs and the need for nurses in those hospitals, and what's driving that, please?
Yes, it's wherever we are able, we do form those partnerships. And you're probably aware Merle West in your area has, in fact, entered into those partnerships with us. Asante in Medford, another health system, actually contributes each year to the nursing program such that we were able to expand the class size by 8 per year. So it's kind of a case by case in terms of whether the health system sees the shortage as impacting their operation right then in that annual budget process. So it's a little bit hard to build programs that way, but it's not hard to augment programs that way, so frequently you can increase your capacity. The scholarship side of it is another avenue. This state has some rural tax credits for practitioners in rural areas. It isn't a scholarship, but it does give them a break on their income tax or state income tax when they practice in certain areas. There is a limited amount of money available for loan forgiveness programs, again, also in rural areas, but it's a very modest amount. Those are programs that could be augmented for, and their loan forgiveness programs are very effective at distribution issues. They don't necessarily build capacity, but they do help with the distribution. So all of those are kind of need to be brought into the public policy discussion when you have a shortage like this. So, yes, absolutely, health systems are partners in these areas.
Senator Whitson, follow up.
Just to follow up on that, what I was really addressing is the potential for scholarships coming from the various hospital and healthcare institutions. Right now, for instance, Rural West is spending almost $1 million a year in excess costs to import nurses into Klamath Falls to provide the services they need. And Paul Stewart would be more than happy to be able to leverage that into scholarships for the nursing care within Klamath to, you know, with a little bit of indentured servitude there, where they'd have to come back and stay at Merle West for a while. I think there's a great opportunity there to leverage that. I think we should be focusing on that.
Okay. And we will. And some of those conversations have begun with the nursing director at Merle West, in fact. So I agree, that's a really fruitful avenue. The challenge sometimes occurs in what is the servitude? I mean, how do you hold those students? Because sometimes they change their mind, but then you can have a loan payback provision. I mean, there are ways to address that.
If it's a private scholarship, you can make your own contract.
You can do things, yes. The performance measures that we use are not rocket science here. We look at the characteristics of the students coming in, their incoming GPA. There are specific tests that dental and medical student applicants take. This is the dental picture over the last several years. The darker color shows you the national average. Our incoming students perform very well set against the national metrics, and similarly for the what are called the MCATs, which are the tests that medical student applicants take. Our students do very well on those. We have a very high quality of incoming students. Our tuition is high. I won't pretend otherwise. As the state dollars have eroded, we have had to increase tuition, and I'll show you in a minute kind of that balance and how that works. We watch that very closely to see if it erodes the applicant pool, to see what effect it has on the applicants, and it has not. It's stayed pretty constant in dentistry. It's very high. We have 750 to 850 applicants for the 75 slots, all highly qualified. And you can see the other little bumps down there show the number of acceptances. Most of the students that we accept us. And so we have a very rich applicant pool. If we could build the capacity, we could train more dentists. Same is true of medicine. We, again, have a very high tuition structure. We're in the top 5 public medical schools in the country. With the governor's recommended budget, were it implemented, we would be the highest public medical school tuition in the country.
Senator Gordley has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Halleck, as we get into the discussion today and tomorrow around performance measures, some of the information we're going to need, and this is where I need to check your understanding, is around your affirmative action performance. What is your understanding, and I'm asking this question of Dr. Kohler as well, what is your understanding of the information that you are to provide to this committee around affirmative action, your affirmative action performance?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I guess my understanding is that we provide to you the number of students that matriculate from a variety of groups to diversify the student body. We also report to you, and that's in upcoming slides, the programs in the pipeline that we have to encourage particularly minority students to be prepared to enter that applicant pool. So we're reporting on both the outcome and the activities of the diversity programs at OHSU.
The chair may want to, I hope the chair will speak to this issue as well. The information that you have gathered for us, and I've previewed it, and I'm picking up on your remarks here, doesn't meet the needs of this committee.
Okay.
Or of the statutory requirement around when we are hearing budget presentations from agencies. We also expect to hear an affirmative action report in detail that talks about the institution itself.
Okay.
And the makeup of administration, faculty, et cetera. That level of detailed presentation is our expectation, I believe. Now, I know I'm going to cite some history here because I was around in 1995 when OHSU became the public corporation, and I know that there was some discussion, some of it kind of contentious around that time, around exemptions that OHSU wanted at that time, exemptions from existing statute. And this affirmative action piece was one of those contentious pieces. Now, the absence of the information that I would expect just leads me to question, again, what is your understanding of what you're supposed to be presenting to this committee? Is that clear?
It is very clear. I understood, based on our testimony 2 years ago, that it was really focused on the educational mission, and so we provided you student data. We certainly have the employee data and the affirmative action programs for employees, and we can bring that to you tomorrow or in phase two hearings at your preference. We followed basically the format that we worked through last time. I do want to indicate we did include, as you know, the affirmative action provisions in the public corporation legislation, and are very much committed to that. Our program has actually grown considerably over the last few years, and so we'd be pleased to talk to you about it.
That would be a complete presentation, because the co-chairs have made it very clear. And I believe I can say this, Mr. Chair, yeah, with your support, the co-chairs have made it very clear that the affirmative action piece is a part of the overall budget presentation. And again, that's why I'm underscoring the need for the information at this time.
Happy to do that. We'll bring it for all employees and not just the educational mission.
To back up Senator Gordley on this, I think it's very clear that the co-chairs actually want to see the information from both perspectives in this, in terms of both sides, both from your employees in terms of recruitment, hiring, retention, and from the standpoint of your students also, because that issue is important to us also in terms of recruitment and admission and retention of students. So I think you're kind of unique in having to present both, but both of those aspects I think are important to the to the legislature and important to this committee. So,
and it's important to us. We have a very diverse patient base, and so having diverse workforce is extremely important. I think I don't need to belabor these metrics. The applicant pools are strong. It's very heartening to see the strength in nursing grow in the applicant pool. That hasn't always been the case around the country, and in the last few years, our program has seen a tremendously strong pool, and that's a typical picture now, as we've already discussed. I want to make one last point on the tuition issue, because it's a very critical one to us. Over the years, as the state dollars have eroded, and that's represented by the darker blue at the bottom of these bars, we have had to increase tuition to make up for it in the educational mission. But I want to point out the flatness of this overall picture, that in spite of the incredible growth of our programs, the growth in the cost of our programs, we have not made up that difference of the expansion and the increased costs out of tuition. We've done it with other means. We've done it with training grants. We've done it with scholarships. We've done it with gifts. And the tuition increase has really been just the sort of hydraulic with the state appropriation as that funding has been decreased. We didn't actually have the data in just the form until this year as we were preparing this, and it's certainly never encouraging to increase tuition, but I was encouraged to see that we have been able to make up the gap of the total cost of the program in other ways. I think at this point what I'd like to do is come back to the diversity question tomorrow, if the committee would allow that, and incorporate into some of the subsequent material, which is really talks about the diversity and pipeline programs in that context tomorrow, and skip ahead to the rural health segment. Is that,
yes, that'd be fine.
So if I could ask Karen Whitaker to come up here. Karen is the Vice Provost for Rural Health. She directs the Center for Rural Health, and I'll have her tell you a little bit about a diverse set of programs that really provides the outreach of all of our missions at OHSU.
Thank you, Dr. Halleck. Senator Devlin, members of the subcommittee, it is truly my pleasure to be here today. For the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the OHSU Center for Rural Health. And I think many of you already know, so I won't belabor this point, that there are some different considerations that you must take when you deliver healthcare services to rural parts of the state versus urban parts of the state. And for some of you, I will be preaching to the choir. Certainly, Senator Nelson and Representative Jensen, we have a history of working together. I know that Senator Gordley was at an event in December where we talked about rural health and asked some very good questions. So I know there is a high level of interest about rural health issues in this legislature. But there are some challenges that exist to delivering health care services in rural areas. Briefly, we have some challenging demographics. We have an older population. We have a poorer population, and they're less likely to have health insurance. We have some health status measures that are different, and that has to do with increased disability, increased death rates from accidents, and also from tobacco use. We have some infrastructure issues that we have fragile hospitals, many of whom experience a negative bottom line year after year, and clinics that have a hard time meeting their operating expenses, and we have, as you've heard earlier today, a shortage of practitioners. If you are if you're living in Portland, one in every 229 people in Portland happens to be a physician. But if you are in rural parts of the state, the ratio is 1 to 874. And if you are in a frontier county, like Representative Jensen hails from, the ratio is more like 1 to 1,335. So we have, for the first time in the year 2000, we had been keeping track of the relationship between growth in population and growth in numbers of physicians. And consistently, since the 1950s, the growth in physicians has outpaced growth in population. And in the year 2000, those lines crossed. So now our population is growing faster than the number of physicians in the state. So I just wanted to reiterate that point for you. You were asking questions about supply of practitioners earlier. 15 years ago, I was privileged to become director of Oregon's Office of Rural Health, located at Oregon Health and Science University, and only the year before, the office had been moved from the Department of Human Services to OHSU. Rural health advocates statewide watched carefully to ensure that the university's commitment to rural health programs would be sustained. And I know that you saw earlier that a lot of things have changed at OHSU since in the last 15 years, but that has not changed. The commitment to our outreach and statewide programs has not only continued, it has increased over the years, as evidenced by 4 years ago, we actually created a center for rural health. And the Center for Rural Health's two main components are the Area Health Education Centers, what we call AHEX, that you've heard mentioned earlier, and the State Office of Rural Health, which is in fact a state agency that is located at Oregon Health and Science University. We also have a telehealth component. We have a coordinator who offers advice on telehealth. I know that Senator Nelson is well acquainted with Kim Hoffman, who has worked closely with him on some of these issues. And we have a resource center at Eastern Oregon University that helps people find resources for the projects that they want to undertake, like writing grants and so on. The Area Health Education Center is about workforce. And we have four centers around the state. And the idea is to improve the education, training, and distribution of healthcare professionals in rural Oregon by training those people in the site where we hope them to eventually practice. And the other component of that, which I'll talk with you about in a bit, is called sort of a grow-your-own approach, where we encourage young people in rural areas to look at healthcare professions as a career. The Office of Rural Health works directly with communities. We recruit and retain practitioners, and we provide technical support to rural clinics and hospitals. And the map up there, I apologize for the very small colored dots on that map, but if we had made them any larger, the map-making person in our office tells me they would have obliterated one another. So we're stuck with these very small dots, but it does give you some idea of how widespread the activities of the OHSU Center for Rural Health are across the state. It lists preceptor sites for our Area Health Education Center's program. It also lists a lot of activities of the Office of Rural Health, where we are recruiting practitioners, where we have placed practitioners, some of the areas where we have provided technical assistance, and the rural hospitals that we have assisted with some federal monies that we receive. The Area Health Education Center's specific services to rural communities, here is just a sampling. They annually provide more than 400 continuing education programs to more than 12,000 health professionals statewide. This is a powerful retention issue for practitioners in rural areas to know that they have the ability to get continuing education. They provide rural training experiences since their inception to more than 1,200 OHSU medical students, and I know you've already heard about the clinical rotations that are required of our medical students, and 162 family medicine residents. Some of the AHECs specialize in meeting the needs of their own region, and the Northeast Oregon AHEC has specialized in emergency medical services. They have trained 1,744 rural emergency medical services personnel. That includes EMTs and first responders, and most of those people are volunteers and would otherwise have had to pay for their own training. And an additional 1,878 have received continuing education. Unfortunately, the funds they used to do that went away in the year 2003, and we're hoping that we are able to get those funds back. It was a portion of the unitary assessment fund that was dedicated to that purpose. This next slide is sort of is what I like to call my supply and demand slide. The differences between the Area Health Education Centers program and the Office of Rural Health actually have to do with making sure there is an adequate supply of practitioners through the Area Health Education Centers program by educating people in situ and by providing training to individuals in the rural training sites and also underserved urban areas, and also health career education support in the last year to 112 high schools and over 8,000 students to encourage those students to seek health care educations. We also have a group called MedStars that comes and spends nearly a week on our campus every summer of high school students, and they are a very enthusiastic group of young people who go to the anatomy lab, they go to the dental school, they really experience a wide range of healthcare educational experiences, and many of them leave very dedicated to having a healthcare career. In the Office of Rural Health, we look at the demands for healthcare assistance throughout the state, and we leverage the investment that we receive from state funds with federal grants to help communities recruit and retain practitioners. This year we have had 159 referrals of candidates to 34 rural sites, and we also have provided technical assistance to rural clinics and hospitals. We've assisted 15 small hospitals to qualify for a special federal program that results in an average of about $250,000 a year in Medicare reimbursement. So this has been very helpful in sustaining their bottom line. The Oregon Office of Rural Health has a legislative mandate in the statute to accomplish a number of activities, and this is a list of some of those activities that the legislature has asked us to do. We were actually first established in 1979 by the state legislature. We assist rural communities with the recruitment and retention of practitioners and provide technical consultation. We support the training and education of rural practitioners and coordinate statewide efforts to provide health care in rural areas. We initiate and participate in policy development that improves the delivery of health care to rural Oregonians, and we collect and analyze information on rural health care systems and providers and serve as a clearinghouse for those data. And we also advocate for rural populations and health care providers, both on the state and in the federal level. But I think the most visible thing that we do for the people of rural Oregon is the hands-on technical assistance that we provide. We have three full-time staff in our office who travel around the state providing technical assistance, and they average about 20,000 miles a year apiece. So the three of them together traveled about 60,000 miles last year around rural Oregon providing hands-on technical assistance to hospitals and clinics, and also providing community development, strategic planning, hospital and clinic board training, needs assessment, and various types of help to rural communities. I think it's important to look at exactly how much this is worth to rural communities and how much the investment that the state is making is a payback to rural communities. We're fortunate in having a very talented staff, some of whom have served as consultants in former lives, could certainly make more money than they're currently making if they were still engaged in private consulting, but have a strong commitment to state service and have come to our office not only to perform those services, but also to train other people in the office. We have a program called the Community Health Improvement Partnership, which is a year-long program that results in a very intensive community-based health planning effort for rural communities. And last year, we did that in two different areas. The consultant who would normally charge $36,000 to that community to provide that service, and so we provided $72,000 worth of services to those two communities. $15,000 in board trainings to Burns, Reedsport, Fossil, Wheeler, Jordan Valley, and Blue River. Strategic planning and community assessment, $75,000 worth to the South Coast Alliance, which is Brookings, Gold Beach, some of the areas in the southern part of the coast, worth $75,000. Management consulting to clinics in Blue River and Halfway, enabling them to realize an increase in their clinic revenues of $23,000 and $40,000 respectively. And we also recruited 14 new practitioners for rural Oregon last year, saving our rural communities about $350,000 in what they would have had to pay to a commercial recruiter for those services. One of the performance measures that has been included in the materials that we provided to you is that we had a goal to leverage the state dollars that we receive and use those dollars to attract federal dollars so that we could provide more services to rural communities. When we first began in 1990, we weren't getting any federal dollars at all. But you can see that the dark blue line on the graph goes up rather sharply, and as evidence of the continuing commitment of OHSU to our office, our budget has remained fairly constant over the years and the amount of state funds that we get through OHSU. And in fact, even during times of decreases in their budget, our budget has sometimes increased slightly. So we're very pleased about that. The funding ratio at this point from 0-0 has gone from 21 to 1. So we're very pleased about that. And most of those funds, rather than pay for additional staff or administrative costs, about two-thirds of those funds are a direct pass-through to rural communities. We just simply pass them through. So Oregon's statewide has really benefited from this increase in federal funding. I think it's very easy for me to sit here and provide you with a lot of statistics and a lot of numbers, and certainly by virtue of the type of committee that this is, that's exactly what you need because of your fiduciary responsibilities. But if you can think for a moment about the people who are affected by the provision of these services, it is a very heartwarming experience personally for me to be a part of this effort. When we first went to Granite, Oregon, they didn't even have telephones in Granite. They had just received telephone service for the first time. They were mourning the death of their mayor, who died of a heart attack because they did not have a defibrillator in Granite. We were able to use the state funds that we were receiving for emergency medical services to buy them a defibrillator. When we first went to Spray, Oregon, they were driving a 35-year-old ambulance. They had to leave the windows down because of the carbon monoxide that came in. You know, you can imagine if it was dangerous for the people who were driving it, what it was like for the people who were riding in it. We were able to buy them a new ambulance with those funds. So it's a very rewarding endeavor to be the director of the OHSU Center for Rural Health. And I really thank you for the support that you give us and for the state funds that we receive to keep doing that work. And I'd be certainly happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you very much.
Senator Nelson.
Since we're almost out of time, I've been sitting here listening to testimony, and I've mentally, I guess it's more for the committee, mentally I've been making lists, you know, necessary, nice, and now I'm adding to my list successful. And, you know, we're going to do the performance measures tomorrow, but if they come out how I suspect they're going to come out, we're going to be able to put this in a successful. I'm somewhat embarrassed by the fact that we're somewhat going through this. I'm thinking, what is the governor's office thinking about by cutting this program 40%? I'm also thinking, we as a legislature, what are we thinking about if we go along with that? I think that our charge as a committee is such that we're supposed to look at programs that do work, that provide services, the most bang for our dollar. And I think this is where this is going to be. The earlier part of the testimony was 27-1 return, and I was just thinking the $40 million cuts basically means a $1 billion reduction if you look at that return. So if we restore that $40 million and then actually restore another $40 million, I mean, we would be doing the state of Oregon a great service. And so, you know, I think one of the decisions, hard decisions we're going to have is, okay, we have K-12 coming in here asking for money. I mean, very essential programs. But where are we going to get the most bang for our dollar? And it looks to me like the program like this, what they're doing, and it not only does it do human things, it does economic development, it does education, and it bridges the urban-rural divide. And I don't see any other program in the state of Oregon that does that at this point, except this one. So, you know where I stand. Well, I'm just talking about, we got to take care of things that take care of the people of the state of Oregon, and this committee better take that as a true charge. And it may be a tough decision for us someplace along the line, but this is a very successful program, and we better restore it and enhance it.
I understand that fully, Senator Nelson. I guess part of the difficulty that this committee faces is that I really don't think that the starting point for this committee is the governor's proposed budget. The governor had very difficult choices to make. He made those choices, but the governor proposes and the legislature disposes of governor's budgets. Clearly, if you look at the two bienniums, this last biennium and this biennium, there are about $6.5 billion under the purview of this committee. However, if you looked at those two bienniums, there's only about a $33 million difference between those two budgets in aggregate for all of educational needs in the state. Given the fact that the governor dedicated about $40 million additional to opportunity grants, it actually tells you that basically for all the other budgets, they have less, and that they basically just moved around a few numbers within those budgets. Clearly, I think I've made the case to the co-chairs, and I think they understand that we can solve some of the problems within these budgets, within the resources that the committee has, but most of the major problems, they're going to have to be part of that solution, because we don't have the resources. If we're going to start from a basis that all the resources we have is what the governor proposed, the governor has his priorities, and the legislature, both House and Senate, both Democratic and Republican members have their priorities, and that's the process we're in. And actually, we're just in the beginning of that process. So, Ms. Halleck, tomorrow we will have one day to get through the remainder of this presentation. We will try to stay on schedule. I will probably ask very fervently with the co-chairs that you have more days during phase two, because I think there will be a lot more questions, and that we also are able to open it up for public comment during phase two, because I think there are members of the public that want to testify in a number of these budgets. I want to thank everyone for being here. I have made a point with this committee for always starting it on time and ending it on time. So with that, I will close the hearing on SB 5522, and we will be adjourned till tomorrow morning at 8:30.